This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Next week, it marks 1 year since the last U.S. troops left Afghanistan.
I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
Welcome to special coverage of Afghanistan, where the Taliban is now effectively in control, including in the capital, Kabul. A takeover of the city has triggered deadly scenes of panic at the airport as people desperately try to leave.
This morning, the flight from Kabul in one stark image. A U.S. military cargo plane reportedly carrying 640 men, women and children, all fleeing Afghanistan for their lives as the Taliban seizes control.
Sunday, President Biden attending the dignified transfer of the flag-draped remains of 13 U.S. service members killed in the suicide attack at Kabul airport while helping evacuate more than 100,000 Afghan allies and American citizens.
Do you think you're going to be able to get on an airplane?
I don't know.
Where do you want to go?
We don't know. Just I want to go there, be safe. Just feel alone.
You don't feel safe?
No.
Sound there from President Biden, the BBC News, ABC News, and PBS last year. When the withdrawal was happening last year, we spoke with Faria and Farouk Kohistani, two sisters living in Worcester who came to Massachusetts from Afghanistan with their mother in 2002. And at that time, Faria said that they both felt devastation and a duty to speak out.
We are definitely worried about potential consequences of us speaking. We're very thankful to be in a country where we do have freedom of speech, where we can talk about and criticize foreign and, you know, our own governments. But we do worry about what the consequences will be of us speaking here. But we felt that it was important to talk about, and something that we can do is raise our voices on our end.
So yesterday afternoon, we sat back down with Faria and Farouk to talk about the one-year anniversary of the troop withdrawal. And we started by asking Faria how she's been reflecting on this last year.
You know, it's been a rough year. There's been a lot happening since the troops have left. You know, a lot of news coming out of Afghanistan, Taliban, you know, flip-flopping on education for women and you know, access to medical care and in trying to help my family who's still there with their cases. It's been a difficult process with hearing back from the USCIS on humanitarian parole applications and SIV applications. It's just been a rough year, and it seems like there hasn't really been any improvement since the troops have left.
So, Farouk, is that what you expected a year ago as this was unfolding? Is this how you thought it would play out?
Unfortunately, it is how I thought it would play out, and I had this sliver of hope that it would be different given the outpour of help that came through when the initial takeover happened. And I'm talking about from normal citizens like yourself, myself, and my community. I mean, they've been super helpful and they continue to help. So I thought with that growing support, there would be a difference made in a year. And although the communities have made a difference in the lives of those that have come into Afghanistan, what's happening in Afghanistan itself and those that are still stuck there, not much change has happened.
It's interesting to hear you say it in terms of not much change, because at the same time, it in fact feels that from the outside, that reports would suggest that for women, it's actually gotten much worse, Farouk.
Yeah, no, thanks for that clarity. 100%, and not a lot has changed, in fact. And I meant positive change, but when we're talking about negative change, unfortunately, girls had to literally turn back home after being told that they are able to study and go into the schools. Upon going to enter the schools, they were turned back home and told that after a certain age, you are no longer allowed to be in school and get an education. And to shatter the dreams and hopes of these women that had futures, they had plans, they had aspirations like all of us do, it's completely devastating, not only for the women, but all the families out there.
So, Faria, earlier this month, The Guardian spoke with women living in the country in Afghanistan about what their life is like today, a year after the departure. I want to read one woman's story. So this is a quote. "Until the Taliban took power, I worked as a police officer. My husband had died, but I could support my two daughters on my police salary. I could give them everything they needed. Now I have lost my job, and the Taliban have been hunting down women who worked in the security services. I'm still terrified they will find me. For the past 7 months, I have been reduced to begging on the streets to feed my girls. I sit all day on the street under a burqa so that nobody recognizes me and informs on me. I don't recognize who I have become. One day, two boys threw some coins at me, and one said I was a prostitute. I went home with only enough to buy 2 loaves of bread for my children, and I cried all night. End of quote. At one level, that feels extreme. At another level, it almost rings familiar. Does it track, for lack of a better word, with what you are hearing from family and community members on the ground in Afghanistan today?
Yeah, I mean, it seems almost an exact copy of what I've heard from, you know, a lot of what my family's been saying. The country is facing, for lack of a better word, mass extinction. Hunger is at an all-time high. Poverty is all-time high. People can't afford to feed themselves, their kids. There have been reports, as I'm sure you're aware, of people like selling their children because they can't feed them. You know, this is the same things that we've been hearing from our family who are there and who have been telling us about kind of the horrors they're currently living in and being exposed to as a result of both the Taliban and the U.S.'s fund freezing.
So, Faria, I don't want to project, but it makes me curious. Do you mostly feel like, oh, thank goodness I got out? Or do you mostly feel, I feel a little guilty that people at home, it's interesting because Farouk, I just want to point out that you smiled when you heard me say that too. So I'd love to hear from both of you. Faria, for you, what's that balance?
Yeah, so for me, I mean, we came to the U.S. when I was 3. So I have no memory of Afghanistan, you know, nothing that I could say this was what we lived like. A lot of my memory is the transition to living in the U.S. and kind of, you know, coming here. I think Farah can speak more to the actual kind of difference there for me. I've never known anything different, but it's still hard. You know I was born there. I know I have family there. I've always wanted to, you know, dreamed of visiting again and kind of get building that connection. But it's so hard to see what my life is like and hear from my cousins that are my age and see like how different our lives are, how, you know, even just on the base level, you know, the education I was able to receive, the way that I live now, being able to drive wherever I want, being able to go wherever I want. It's so much guilt and anger and frustration at just kind of the world that like what's happening. And I do feel a little bit of that guilt that like we were able to get out and they're still stuck there.
Farouk, how about you?
Yeah, I think the guilt has actually heightened over the past year. Before, you know, I felt for my family that's still there because it's still restrictive there, given, you know, Afghanistan's been in war since anyone can remember. But they had freedoms. They had certain rights. They had fun. I went and visited, actually, in 2016, and I saw, and the life there seemed good. Like, everyone was enjoying it. There were people, not everyone was dying to leave the country. They were enjoying their lives. But then this happened, and over the past year, I find myself sometimes when I'm doing something for fun, feeling guilty, remembering that my family's back there and they're suffering. And every day their thought is, will I get through today? Will I be able to make it to tomorrow? Will I get myself and my children out of this country? And we actually have family that is in danger as well because of the work that they did with the American government before. So like the story that you shared previously, it resonates with us because our family's going through this similar thing of being a target. So yeah, I would definitely say the guilt is still there, and the guilt has heightened over the past year of just finding myself feeling grateful that I'm here and I'm safe and I'm able to have all these freedoms, but also guilty of like, why can't my cousins do that? And are they seeing, like when I post something, I'm like, are they seeing this? Do they feel a sense of emptiness because they're not able to do certain things?
We're talking with Faria and Farouk Kohistani. Their father and brother fled Afghanistan in 1998. And in 2002, the sisters left the country with their mother. They live in Worcester. Faria, it strikes me, you're not just anywhere, you're in Massachusetts, which is a mecca of education. And of course, as we've watched what's unfolded for women under the Taliban over this last year and the return to women being deprived of education, do you find that our educational culture here in Massachusetts is something that's particularly precious to you now?
Yeah, absolutely. I talk all the time about how I'm thankful that we ended up in Massachusetts. You know, education across even the U.S. is variable, I guess, is a way to put it. And for us to have landed in Massachusetts, where education is usually ranked, you know, Massachusetts is usually ranked one or two in in the country was phenomenal. You know, I went to public school and I don't feel like I've ever missed on anything. I feel like my education was complete and far above what some of my friends were talking about. You know, I was in college and talking to people from other states. And so growing up, my mom always told us, you know, education is incredibly important because she was around during the first rise of the Taliban and, you know, with the Mujahideen and all that stuff happened. And so she will always make sure that we were putting our education first. And so this year when I was, you know, doing my applications for med school again, I reflect on that a lot. Like, you know, I'm able to do this application. I'm able to attend. I was able to attend college. I was able to attend high school. There's no real limit on the amount of education that I can receive. And yet, as Farah said, girls were being turned away from doors. They were told, you can't have any more. And there was also that initial, you know, the promise from the Taliban that women and girls were going to be able to get an education. And I was shocked at the amount of people who believed them, because as soon as they were able to kind of pull the rug out from underneath anybody who believed that statement and, you know, showed their true colors that they would never allow women to gain an education because of what it would mean for them and the power that they hold.
What kind of doctor do you want to be?
That's up in the air for now, but I'm hoping, you know, either emergency medicine or general surgery.
And Farouk, do you think that your family members who are still in Afghanistan and in danger have a hope of being able to leave?
100%. I think they're holding on to hope. And I think we said the same thing last year. Hope is one of those things that you can't let go. That's what keeps you going. That's what keeps you driven. That's what makes you move through the days and get by. Because as soon as they lose hope, that is when we'll know that the entire system, we already know, has failed them. But as soon as they all lose hope, that's it. I think that's the final tip of the iceberg of, like, okay, we have managed to fail a whole country of people to the point where they no longer even have hope for anyone in the world to get them out. Not only are we talking about the U.S., we're talking about the entire world. So I think, yes, they're still very much hopeful, and we're still here trying our best to continuously work and find ways to get them out anywhere.
Farouk Kohistani there and her sister Faria. They left Afghanistan in 2002. They currently live in Worcester. We spoke with them for the first time last August when the U.S. troops withdrew from Afghanistan and checked back in with them yesterday afternoon. And now we turn to Jake Auchincloss. The Marine veteran represents Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District and served in Afghanistan. Congressman, thank you for joining us to reflect on this past year.
I appreciate you having me back on.
It's great to have you. There's a lot to talk about, but I know you heard the remarks from the sisters. So let me start with your reactions.
Well, it's both emotionally painful, and I also feel an element of pride. It's painful because hearing your description and their descriptions of what it's like for women and girls in Afghanistan is wrenching. And I also feel a measure of pride that in the United States, young women like those two could come here as immigrants at a young age and achieve so much and have such a bright future ahead of them. It speaks to what is deeply right about this country, even as we know there is so much deeply wrong about Afghanistan.
I don't want to ask the cheap question, especially after that, but I do want to ask the question, which is, last year when we spoke with you during withdrawal, you supported President Biden's move. You referred to it as presidential. I recognize we just heard some tough information about the after effect over this last year. Knowing what you know now, do you still feel as strongly as you did then that it was the right move and the presidential move?
Yes. President Biden didn't have a good decision on his desk when he took office. President Biden had a bad decision and a worse decision. We are in a situation where the Taliban was at their strongest militarily in 20 years, really since 9/11, and in which the U.S. troop presence was at its lowest in 20 years. And President Biden had two choices. One, he could surge. He could send another 50,000-100,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan to engage with the Taliban as they launch their fighting season in May of 2021, as they promised to do. Or he could end our longest war that had not accomplished its political objectives and free up American bandwidth and resources to focus on threats from China and Russia. He made the hard call. He made the presidential call. It was a painful call. It's still a painful call. But he had to put the U.S. national interest first.
We litigated at that time and in the weeks afterward, you know, the process of the withdrawal itself. I'd like to know if there's anything since then, in that year since then, that you think the U.S. could have or should have done differently, or you wish we had done differently.
Well, we need to expand Operation Allies Welcome. Operation Allies Welcome has taken more than 100,000 Afghans, evacuated, granted them humanitarian parole. I said from the very beginning and continue to say we should be taking more. We should be continuing to work with nonprofit organizations to help extract high-risk Afghans from Afghanistan, and should continue to help the more than 800 Americans that we've extracted since the withdrawal. And then we've got to pass the Afghan Adjustment Act. After Cuba, after Vietnam, after Iraq, we passed adjustment acts that allowed those who were born in those countries to build new lives here in the United States. We've got the legislation, it's got bipartisan co-sponsorship, and we owe it to the Afghan people to pass the Afghan Adjustment Act and allow those more than 100,000 Afghans who are here now to build new lives in the United States.
And just to underscore for listeners, because their future ability to remain in the country currently is uncertain, Congressman, is that correct?
That's right. So they were granted, the vast majority were granted humanitarian parole to come here, which expires next August. So we've got 1 year to get this right. And, you know, I'll name names. It's Senator Grassley in the Senate who is opposing this bill right now. And it's hard not to question motives, I'll tell you. These are some of the most thoroughly vetted individuals in all of history. I mean that quite literally. And yet he's still claiming that there is some kind of security threat here. It just reeks of xenophobia. We need to be welcoming these people and helping them build new lives. And I'm proud that Massachusetts has been leading on that initiative, but there's more to do. I also want to pivot to Afghanistan itself. We can help the 100,000, 200,000 or so who are here, but of course there's more than 30 million in Afghanistan. And hunger is an acute problem right now in that country. The United States is the largest humanitarian donor to Afghanistan, but we need to do more, and we need to do as much as it takes for as long as it takes, because children nowhere should be hungry. We also have to recognize that humanitarian aid is not a long-term strategy, and we should be looking at partnerships with Western mining companies to try to build a mining industry in Afghanistan. Western mining can do what Western militaries never could, which is put Afghanistan on a path of sustainable self-sufficiency.
So I want to underscore first the data. According to the United Nations, 24 million Afghans are in need of humanitarian assistance, and nearly 20 million people face acute food insecurity. So to your point, one of the things that has been controversial is the executive order that President Biden signed earlier this year that essentially took resources frozen from the central bank in Afghanistan and allocated them to a couple of different purposes. And one was holding some of those assets for the possibility of lawsuits from 9/11 victims. The pushback has been that is taking resources that belonged to the people of Afghanistan and applying it to a terrorist attack where there were no Afghans involved. I know it's a more complicated picture than that, but are we using the resources we've seized appropriately and correctly, Congressman?
It's a terrific question. These frozen assets, about $3.5 billion by my last reckoning, need to be treated as part of a comprehensive plan to exert leverage over the Taliban. So we've got the $3.5 billion of frozen assets. We've got our ability to send both economic and military support to the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan that is still fighting the Taliban and is increasingly well organized. We have our ability to do over the horizon counterterrorism strikes. We, of course, have basic humanitarian and economic aid both from the United States and through the United Nations. These all collectively comprise points of leverage in dealing with a brutal regime. And we've got to be using them in concert to secure the release of Mark Frerichs, the contractor that they're unjustly holding there, to win concessions on their treatment of women and girls, and to chart a path forward for economic development, because we cannot allow Afghanistan to devolve into a narco-terror state. We need to be working to build up industries for copper, rare earth elements, lithium, nickel, lapis lazuli. Afghanistan has these ores in abundance. They are in huge demand globally. And it's in the best interests of the United States and the Afghan people that they be mined sustainably and for the benefit of the Afghan people.
So I want to come back home. You praised Massachusetts' approach to supporting people who left Afghanistan. According to the Associated Press, nearly 2,000 have resettled in the Commonwealth. We actually had a fascinating conversation earlier this year with a program at UMass in Worcester that is working on job skills and training. In general, are we doing everything we should be as a Massachusetts community to live up to our obligations?
My office has worked with more than 100 Afghan refugees as they are working through federal paperwork. And I have also been able to speak to many communities in the civic and nonprofit space, whether they're temples or churches or others that are welcoming Afghan refugees. And they're doing terrific work. I think, as always with federal bureaucracy, we're making it too complicated. I mean, there's a lot of paperwork. And that paperwork is complicated for native English speakers who have grown up here, much less for recent arrivals from Afghanistan. So we work hard to try to simplify that. And there's always more that we should be doing. Massachusetts was founded by refugees 400 years ago. And we are richer as a state when we dig in and when we welcome those who are newly coming to our shores.
I'd like to take this opportunity to pivot and talk with you for just a couple of minutes about something else. We often talk about national security with you. You're a Massachusetts congressman from the 4th District, a Marine veteran, but you also serve on the subcommittee on national security, international development, and monetary policy. And we've spoken with you quite a bit over the last, since 2021, about the January 6th attempted insurrection. So I want to pick up on those threads for just a minute. We had a far-right organization protest in Chelsea, in front of the FBI offices over the weekend, responding to the FBI's execution of a warrant in President Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence, the former president's residence. The organizers said, quote, "The Bureau has gone rogue and is now a partisan police force trampling all over our constitutional rights," end quote, and then went on to say, quote, "The FBI must be disbanded following criminal prosecutions of all deep state abusers of power," end quote. Are you concerned to see this kind of protest against the FBI in Chelsea, here in Massachusetts, with that kind of rhetoric?
I'm concerned to see it anywhere. I'm not surprised. It's remarkable. I took office 18 months ago, and the GOP was constantly chirping about Democrats wanting to defund the police. I'll tell you, I've seen two instances of trying to defund the police in my time in Congress. One, after the January 6th insurrection, the Republicans voted against funding the Capitol Police. And number two, right now they're calling to defund the FBI. I mean, isn't it just shocking that when Donald Trump is trying to be held to account for flagrantly and repeatedly breaking the law, that all of a sudden it's the GOP that wants to defund the police? It would be laughable if it were not so deeply, deeply destabilizing for our democracy. I'm not going to weigh in on individual investigations. That is inappropriate for elected officials. We've got independent law enforcement. But I absolutely expect that the FBI, as well as state prosecutors, follow the facts and the law, and that they treat every single American equally under the law, including a former president of the United States, and that they hold him to account for what the facts suggest is a repeated abuse of power and just rampant corruption.
We're talking with Massachusetts Congressman Jake Auchincloss. I know you're on a tight schedule. Do you have time for one or two more questions?
Yes.
Great. So I understand you won't weigh in on individual investigations. Do you think there is any fair criticism of the Bureau or the Department of Justice to be levied about how they've handled this situation at Mar-a-Lago?
Nothing I have seen to date suggests that Merrick Garland did anything other than follow the facts and adhere to the law in his investigation.
And with your level of experience, can you draw the dot, connect the dots back to Massachusetts for us on the importance of the classified and sometimes top secret documents that have been reported were taken from Mar-a-Lago? How does that or could that affect the people, let's say, that you're elected to represent?
It's one more instance in a long pattern of Donald Trump seeing everything through the lens of money signs. And it's just clear that whether it was his ability to collect gifts from the Saudi Arabians or the peddling of his golf courses overseas on his state visits, that he just treated the public office, which belongs to the American people and which is funded by the American taxpayer, as his own base for cronyism and corruption. He's like a second-rate mob boss. And this is just one more instance of that. I don't know all the details of every single classified document that they found. I see reports that it's more than 300. But my strong supposition is that what Donald Trump was really thinking is there's money here somehow.
All right. That is Massachusetts Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who represents the 4th District, also a Marine veteran who served in Afghanistan. Congressman, good to have you. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.